Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Chattanooga Choo Choo by Glenn Miller, a big band number of 1941, is a celebration of the pleasures of going by train, a fast train, in the United States. It didn't provide, not that this was Glenn Miller's job, and I'm not by any imagination thinking that, everybody should be providing realism, but it didn't provide much of a clue to the myriad difficulties of American rail. In contrast, written 10 years earlier, there was the more atmospheric, differently atmospheric, maybe I should say, "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" I won't even try an American accent. "Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?" The lament was written by the lyricist E.Y. Yip Hoberg and part of the 1932 musical New Americana, which was number one in popularity that year. Indeed, the railway expansion of the late 19th century had proved difficult to sustain in the face of an upsurge in antitrust pressure and federal intervention from the 1900s. And I want to labour that point because, as I've tried to make clear throughout these lectures, it's often government that posed the problem rather than being the solution. Federal intervention began with labour, with railway charges, but extended to labour conditions. 1916, the Adamson Act, the first federal law regulating the hours of workers in private companies, was passed in order to avoid a nationwide strike. It established what the rules were for interstate railway workers. And in 1917, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Act, which was all very well as long as railways made a profit, but they didn't really seem to have thought about that. In December 1917, under the Army Appropriations Act of the previous year, the railways were nationalized in America as a wartime measure and placed under the United States Railroad Administration, which retained control until March 1920. The railways were organized into 3 divisions, east, west, and south. Duplicate passenger services were reduced, which undermined the logic of many of the companies. Priority was given to freight, which obviously undermined passenger service, and standardized locomotives were ordered. After the return to peacetime conditions, a greater degree of control of railways survived in the shape of the Interstate Commerce Commission, same sort of principle of the regulation today. In other words, government and law had moved from serving the interests of the railways and trying to maintain their profitability and productivity to regulating them. And after the return to peacetime conditions, a higher cuts to wages paid to maintenance and repair workers, in other words, they moved away from the high rates of pay of wartime, provoked the Great Railway Strike of 1922. About 400,000 workers struck. And, there was violence, sabotage. The whole thing was a complete mess. At the same time, there were the other classic iniquities of American society. African-American railway workers were poorly treated, given the low-paying jobs, excluded from the unions, just as the trade unions in Britain were often racist and anti-women, although the people tend to sanitize that out of the account of trade union history. So the same was true in the United States. And African-American railway workers were expected to behave with civility. In the 1920s, while white stewards working in Pullman cars had sleeping berths, African-American dining car men were expected to sleep on the dining car tables. Like the porters, they were at least partly visible, unlike the many African-Americans who put in hard work in building and maintaining the system. So there was racial inequity in the system. State regulation was presented as a way to ensure that a public service acted accordingly in the interests of the public, even though privately owned. But the central problem with this approach was that, as indeed was frequently to be seen in Britain, of ensuring sufficient investment. The period had seen the culmination of earlier plans, for example, the rail link from San Diego to the east, which was finished in 1919. But the, you know, to give an example of that railway, the San Diego and Arizona Railway, 146 miles, once complete, the line was hit by landslides in 32, rainstorms in 26, 27, and 29, fires in 32, disputes with Mexico, across which part of the line ran. And in 1932, the founder's heirs sold their share to the Southern Pacific. So yet again, system extension, and this was more generally the case, did not equate with profitability. Freight movements did ensure that American rail companies generally did well in the war and into the 1920s, but the depression of the 1930s was a very difficult, different matter. There had already been, of course, still technological innovations in America in 1925, the first commercially successful diesel-electric locomotive to enter service, as well as the first modern so-called superpower steam locomotive. More significant, as is often the case, was not the engines or, in fact, the rolling stock that people tend to look at, but actually organizational innovation. And in 1927, the key innovation was the American Centralized Traffic Control System, that was its name, which helped ensure safe running. It was installed first on a stretch of the New York Central Railroad and enabled the train dispatcher to control train movements directly rather than relying on local operators with all the potential inefficiencies as well as costs that could entail. Now, the Depression hit railway companies not only with greater reduced freight and passenger business, but also because of the scarce availability and high cost of credit. Smaller companies found it difficult to manage their debt, again, a feature that one sees whenever interest rates go up, which meant that they could be taken over. Railway income itself fell from a profit of $977 million in 1929 to a loss of $122 million in 1932. And there were further deficits in 33, 34, and 38. This fall led to a major decline in maintenance, in railway employment. The strikes had not been a brilliant idea from that point of view. By squeezing profitability, they hit jobs down the line, and in locomotive sales. And the cut in locomotive sales drove up the cost purchase, the cost, the unit cost of new purchases. There was a sort of, as partly as a result, existing locomotives weren't replaced, which meant that they became more obsolescent. In general, in America, the manufacturing base was hit hard by the Depression, and that hit rail in particular. As a result of the highly leveraged nature of most companies, by 1938, about a third of all railroad mileage in the United States was in bankruptcy. And individual companies were declaring bankruptcy. So, for example, the Missouri Pacific, which had already declared bankruptcy in 1915, did so again in 1933, entering into a trusteeship that lasted until 1956. The larger companies, which had more access to outside finance, were able to, on the whole, continue maintenance. But those in difficulty saw their system decline, and the aggregate system declined. Moreover, the Depression brought the earlier issue of the spread of car use to a head. In 1929, the railways already provided far fewer passenger miles than cars did, although the situation was far less bleak for freight. with one in five American households having cars, and petrol, of course, being very cheap, it was not surprising that a number of prominent companies, such as the Rock Island in 1933, the Chicago and Northwestern in 35, the Milwaukee Road in 35, the New York, New Haven and Hartford in 35, and the Erie in 1938, all went bankrupt. Whereas in 1916, the American rail industry had handled 1 billion passenger journeys. There was only 700 million by 1930, and that would fall another 36% in the 1930s. And because there wasn't a commensurate decline in the network, what that meant is that each mile of network was having less passenger revenue supporting it. Nevertheless, there were still improvements in the 30s with significant initiatives in existing services. In 1931, mechanical systems of air conditioning were first applied to an entire train on the New York-Washington service. Shop welding was developed in the 1930s to join stainless steel. It replaced the earlier use of riveting and greatly speeded up the production of locomotives. And this was an application to railways of the use of all steel automobile or car bodies. The company was developed by the Philadelphia-based Budd Company, and the company's stainless steel streamlined rolling stock were known as silver liners and began with the diesel-powered Pioneer Zephyr of 1934, which was built for the Chicago, Burlington and Quincy Railroad. The Pioneer Zephyr set a speed record for travel between Denver and Chicago and was the inspiration for the film The Silver Streak of 1934, which used the original train for the external shots and is well worth seeing if you're interested in rail, offering a very different account to, as it were, the night mail we were citing last week. There's a heroic emergency journey as the train rushes seven iron lungs to the Boulder Dam, where there is an outbreak of polio. In other words, one new American icon, the dam being linked to the train. The drama includes a fugitive wanted for attempted murder. And this was one of the more dramatic train films of the interwar period. Followed by the General Pershing Zephyr, constructed in 1939, I mean, other trains came in between, which was the first passenger train to have fitted disc brakes. And that, again, was an application of car technology. Streamlined trains suggested modernity, and there was an attempt to provide more appeal for long-distance passengers, not least with the introduction of truly impressive streamliner services. So the streamliner trains were matched to new services which emphasize speed, punctuality, and so on. And new deal loans led to the electrification of some of the prime lines, such as the Pennsylvania Railway's track between New York City and Washington. The mileage of American railways that were owned, not all of these were operated, fell from 249,000 in 1930 to 234,000 in 1940. So that was a fall of 5%, contrasting with the fall in the 1920s of 1%. So there are fewer miles, but as I've said, it's more, the crisis is more, there are fewer passengers. At the same time, there was flexibility. For example, as an enticement to marry in Las Vegas, there was a license bureau in the train station. And rail continued. Okay, there were road and there was there were aeroplanes, but rail continued to be an important part of America's image of itself. Portrait of America, 1939, which was a double-page illustration in the America's Future issue of Life magazine, which was published on the 5th of June, pictured a train headed west, a classic image from the 19th century. And trains continued to play a major role in interwar American films, not least those of Buster Keaton, such as One Week, in which his newly built house stuck on a train crossing is destroyed by a train, or The General, in which Keaton saves a train hurtling towards its destruction. However, Although these developments were impressive, they couldn't fundamentally change the economics of rail. That really improved following the recovery from the Depression and because of the demands of war. America joined the war, of course, in December 1941, but it already began to mobilize for it in 1940, particularly with the Two Oceans Act for the build-up of a big navy able to operate on both the Atlantic and the Pacific. And there was, as a result of that, more investment. Engines became more powerful, so that the Union Pacific, which already had developed the 9000 class, introduced from 1941 what was called the Union Pacific Big Boy engines, which weighed more than 600 US tons and were able to produce over 5,500 horsepower. These mount engines could pull loads over the mountains of the Rockies. The density of American railways was not matched in other large countries, but there was a degree of catch-up with the American model, for example, in Canada. But again, in Canada, there was the financial problems, which led indeed to the establishment by the government in 1919 of Canadian National Railways, which was a for all of the companies in difficulties, uneconomic services taken over for public ownership, which then in fact faced difficulties, whereas Canadian Pacific, the private company, did better. The Australian economy was badly hit by the Depression of the 1930s. The profitability of Australian rail declined. But the rail system there was very clearly, again, as in Canada and America, an economic necessity and a strategic reserve. The only problem was who was going to pay for it. The same was true of India, where the very large and impressive Indian Railway Staff College, inaugurated in 1930, might seem an appropriate image for the interwar years, were it not for the fact that retrenchment led to it being closed the following year. I mean, this is a classic thing for a historian. You've got to be so careful. So many books are so shoddy because they will use one of those, the fact that this college was founded, and ignored the fact that it was actually closed the following year. Well, actually, what happened to it is it was closed and then sold to the military as a staff college. In India, the combination of the Depression with road competition led to the increasing lack of profitability and creditworthiness of the railways. And indeed, this in Burma, which was a separate political entity under the British Raj, the state-owned Burma railways became Burma's largest debt items. And as a result of that, plans for a line from Rangoon in Burma to China couldn't be pursued, though in my view, not least because of the terrain and the forest cover, the plan wasn't viable in any case. And indeed, I think it's fair to say that the same can be seen elsewhere. Many of the projects for that had been developed in the late 19th century and indeed in the early 20th century were just simply not pursued. For example, in French Indochina, the plan to link a projected Cambodian railway to Saigon and to Thailand went absolutely nowhere, as well as a plan for a line parallel to the coastal line in Vietnam, but further inland. That went absolutely nowhere. There was no lines apart from a 4.3-mile portage railway. That's one to go around some rapids. No lines in Tool in Laos. And, you know, one's got to, you know, as I said, so many people write the history of rail round what is achieved. It's worth bearing in mind what isn't achieved. And indeed, Viet Ninh, the capital of Laos, only gained a rail link in 2021. So many, many, many years after it had been projected. And what that reminds us is that America and Europe didn't define the experience of rail. I mean, you might say that's self-evident, but what we see is that if you focus on individual countries, it's not just a matter of the economy and it's not just a matter of the topography, but also the significance of differing systems of governmental control and regulation and of contrasting public ideologies. Politics was to the fore in the determination of governments when they wanted to develop rail systems, as with today, China as opposed to America, and notably so with authoritarian systems where there was not a comparable emphasis on road transport. This was the case with the Soviet Union and its communist ethos of heavy industry, which was intended to contribute to the dictatorship of the proletariat, among whom the rail workers were regarded as a key element. In June 1918, Lenin, who of course had famously arrived at the Finland station in St. Petersburg from exile in 1917 by train, wrote a draft decision for the Council of People's Commissars on the need to rehabilitate rail transport and keep the industry Soviet under state control. Rail was to be used by the communists indeed to spread the message by means not just of troop use during the Russian Civil War, but also by special propaganda trains. And indeed, you know, you have to be careful with claims figures by the communists, but the Soviet network, as claimed, rose from 81,000 kilometres in 1917 to 106,000 in 1940. And in that period, the amount of freight allegedly increased fourfold. There were certainly aspirations, including classes of powerful locomotives. The Joseph Stalin, manufactured from 1932 to 1942, of which 649 were built. Another one was named after the original head of the Cheka, the secret police. 3,213 were built of those. There was also stronger track thanks to heavier rails and better ballast, heavy rolling stock, automatic brakes and coupling, and better signalling. And the importance of rail was shown by Stalin's close associate, Kaganovich, being People's Commissar for Transport in 35 to 37 and 38 42. So with his predecessor, Andreev, who held the post in 31 to 35. It proved, however, to be that this was not always the best of jobs to have. The holder, Bakulin, who held the post in 37 to 38, was executed in 39, as was Rukimovich the year before, who had held the post in 30 to 31. Now, in 26, and this gives you some idea that it wasn't all sweetness and light in actually what they achieved. I mean, incidentally, after Andreev, they built a locomotive, the AA-20, which had the largest number of coupled axles on a locomotive, which was 14, and the longest rigid frame locomotive in Europe. That sounds great, doesn't it? In fact, it was too heavy, too large for turntables, subject to derailments and withdrawn from service. In 1926, construction began on a line linking the magnetic mountain, the iron ore mountain that was to become the gigantic steel city of Magnitogorsk, to the rail system through a junction 145 kilometers away. Steel production at Magnitogorsk depended on the moving of coking coal nearly 2,000 kilometers from Western Siberia. Well, you know, looked good in the plans, but only 40 kilometers of track were constructed by the end of 1928. In 1929, the work was renewed and completed with military assistance, but the track was put down without ballast, and due to repeated accidents, a speed limit of 10 kilometers an hour was imposed. And as a result of the poor state of the line, there were major problems with capacity. There were therefore resulting bottlenecks that hit production. Much of the rolling stock for Magnitogorsk in the mid-30s was inoperative. There was a severe shortage there of rails and ties. Recently repaired locomotives required repairs almost immediately. And in 1936, it could take as long as 2 weeks for freight to pass from one shop, one manufacturing part of the Magnitogorsk plant, to another. In other words, quantity claimed proved no guidance to quality of output. I suppose you could say, however wasteful there was output, but I don't think that actually reflected well on the communist system or on Soviet government. A major new line was planned under the old order, but built largely between 27 and 30, was the Turkestan-Siberia Railway. That was built, but in a sense, that owed a lot to the use of forced labour, much of which died during the process, with the secret police playing a major role. Peasants were frequently moved to perform forced labour, and gulags proved a major source of manpower for new construction. And this was especially true of railways in northern Siberia. The general tendency across the world in the 1930s was for increased state control. The impact of the Depression on the private sector was significant in this. And what that meant was that, as it were, the private sector was failing to be able to generate the revenues, and the state intervened largely in order to stop, in capitalist countries, to stop the rail companies going bust. We've already mentioned nationalisation in France, but in 1938, the two rail companies that still exist in the Netherlands were merged with all the stocks state-owned. And I think it's fair to say that although there was a major contrast between the Soviet Union with its focus on rail and the United States, where there was state regulation but without financial support, I think it's fair to say that many countries, although they didn't have the same degree of focus on rail as the Soviet Union had, nevertheless felt unable, or were unable, to leave it to the private sector, because the private sector just simply couldn't generate the funds. More positively, states were not facing the encumbrance of the enormous expenditure on social welfare and health, which helps to weaken so many Western states today. The common element was the extent to which in the 30s, the rail industry was affected by the political context, rather than being able to define the future in terms of technology and appropriate investment. In America and Europe, the ability of rail to provide a comprehensive service for freight and passengers had gone, never to return. In certain countries, the resulting financial problems for companies then appeared to bolster the case for nationalisation. Meanwhile, prior to World War II, there was not the detailed planning with railway timetables that featured before 1914. There was some interest in what war would mean. There were talks between the government and the railway companies before 39 in Britain about the finances of the latter in wartime, but there were no significant attempts in Britain or America to direct rail operations or capacity in the pre-war rearmament period. Yet the new World War was to place great pressure on rail systems to hit the profitability then and later of companies, and to make state control more normative. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about World War II next time. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I'm very interested in what you were saying about the development of trains in the United States, but also in the Soviet Union over the same period. What's the technology of these large trains? And I'm presuming these very large trains in both countries are needed because of the generally longer distances they were often traveling compared to national lines within Europe. But that's my assumption. Correct me if that wasn't the rationale. But did they develop along very similar engineering ideas, or did they were they fundamentally very different?
Well, I think it's fair to say they were fundamentally similar. As I mentioned last time, the major difference, I would say, is there's more electrification in some countries than others, and in parts of some systems. So I mentioned last time that, you know, Italy, the Soviet Union, and America had a fair amount of electrification. And in Britain, the southern region did. But large parts of the system around the world remained heavily or totally reliant on coal, in part because of the absence of available electric, in part because You know, if the cost of investing in new locomotives, and in part because the real cost of the labour was low. I mean, remember, a coal-powered train requires more crew, you know, stokers, etc., and not just to run the train, but also to maintain it and to steam it up beforehand. So that's a cost element. But the cost of labour was not as great in the 30s as it was to be in the 50s.
We spoke in a previous episode about the rationalisation of trains in the UK into the big four companies. During the 20s and 30s in America and in the United States, was there a similar level of concentration? How many significant rail companies were there? And did some very small localized companies still continue to exist in this world?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. No, small localized companies could continue to exist if they had, if they were profitable, or if nobody wanted to take them over. And that, for example, you've got to remember when you're talking about companies, we're extending all the way to urban transit systems, and many of which were very specific to individual municipalities. You also get some very small railways that, in a sense, exist in order to move, let us say, coal from coal mines to a coal port. So no, there's a lot of small companies left, but there's a measure of consolidation. I mentioned some of the railway companies that went bust. Now, sometimes when they go bust, what that actually means is an enforced recapitalization. And sometimes they have to sell part of their assets. Sometimes it means takeovers. All of those existed. The key thing is there wasn't a government direction of the process as existed in Britain in the early 20s, nor was there a nationalisation.
It was there in the United States. The focus, you said, that went on to freight transport after the First World War. Was that perhaps maybe not such a bad idea, given the availability and spread of personal motor cars for civilians during, particularly by the 30s? In a strange way, did the regulators make the right call?
Well, I think you've got to bear in mind that in mass transit systems in places like Chicago and New York, you've still got large numbers of people moving by rail. So I think that the what is getting hit are those long distance rail services which are not sufficiently profitable to encourage investment, and which are losing traffic, partly to do with the fact that many of them hadn't really been viable in the first place, but partly to do in the impact, particularly in low density areas, of more attractive use of cars. And also something we need to remember, which is buses. Bus services are very important.
A final question about developments in Southeast Asia that you touched on, Burma being a case in point of a railway line to China that never got built, partly for reasons of the difficulty of the terrain, but also the indebtedness of Burma railways. In these Southeast Asian countries, which are either British or French or Dutch colonies, is there essentially one company dominant, a private company dominant, that is making the investments, or are they effectively, directly or indirectly, under the colonial government's control?
Oh, it varies it varies very much by which imperial system you're looking at. I mean, in British India, there are a number of companies, and there is there is state ownership of part of the system, but there's also a number of private companies. The private companies become less viable in the 30s and early 40s as a result of the Depression, and also, incidentally, the squeeze of profitability in some respects due to the war, which means you can't really put up your prices. But I think you'd be making a mistake if you thought everything was under state direction. It very much depends upon the degree to which there is profitability. So let me give you an instance of this. Even when you might think there is government control, you will still, for example, in the West Indies, find individual rail lines running as part of large plantations or linked to mineral extraction, which are either private or de facto, or de facto under the control of the plantation or the port or the mine. And indeed, that practice continues to the present day. I mean, I think I'm right in saying if you look at Mauritania today, the longest railway is one which doesn't take passengers and is really to move iron ore to the coast. And it's one in which the iron ore company plays the key role. So I think what one has to do is to think about a distinction between a general purpose provider. So in other words, a railway, which let's say it's doing freight, will take freight from anybody who is willing to pay the fare, and a company which is very specific to a individual need. And indeed, there are occasions when the same thing is true, much more limited fashion, but the same thing can be true of passenger services. So, for example, trains that are as part of military facilities or linked to military needs, classic instance of that. But I think one's got to be careful about assuming that the definition of a rail system is one which is open to a member of the public, either for corporate purposes, for freight, or as an individual, to move on and to purchase the services of. That isn't the case.
Well, all very fascinating. This has been a rich tapestry taking us along the railways and railroads of America, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and the Soviet Union in the years between the two world wars. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much. And I hope people have been interested, and we'll be moving on to World War II next week.